If you were going to take over the American economy, this would be a pretty good time to do it. On a Jobs Day Friday from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is December the 2nd, Friday, as I said. Good to have you along, everybody. Another week, another turn in what is soon to be the Donald J. Trump economy. The November jobs report that we got this morning noted we added 178,000 new ones last month. The unemployment rate dropped to 4.6%, which is where we start our digest of the past 5 days. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post is with us. Also, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, I'm right, right? I mean, forget it, setting aside for a minute that Mr. Trump doesn't believe the jobs numbers.
He might soon, right?
This is a good economy he's inheriting.
Oh, absolutely. These are fabulous tailwinds on which to sail into the White House. the unemployment rate is low. Wage growth has been pretty strong. Employers are saying that they can't find enough talent. These are exactly the conditions that you want when you are entering the Oval Office and that are almost polar opposite to those that Obama inherited 8 years ago.
Right. No, exactly. One wonders then, Sudeep, what Mr. Trump will do. I mean, you could argue that with an economy growing at 3.2%, as it was in the most recent quarter, and with jobs at 4.6%, we don't need, minus the fact that our bridges are falling down, we don't economically need a huge infrastructure bill.
If you're a president taking office in a change moment like Trump is taking office right now, you don't want these numbers because they're really hard to improve. It's hard to improve a 4.6% unemployment rate. It's hard to improve when you have structural problems in the economy to improve 2 or 3% growth, given what we're dealing with labor force participation and other issues. So that is a president would generally want to inherit what Barack Obama inherited because it's much easier to improve something like that.
Right.
And Trump's challenge will be to deal with the very hard, difficult structural issues that have been building up for decades. And those cannot really be changed easily under a presidential term.
Unless, Catherine Rampell, you pick up the phone and you call the CEO of Carrier and say, hey, listen, you got to stay in this country. Can we talk for a minute about what appears to be the new American industrial policy?
Sure. I'm not sure that this is an industrial policy that scales particularly well, given that there are a lot of other firms that are leaving the U.S. for lower wage rate pastures. And I don't think that the president can bully all of them into staying. And I mean, bully isn't really the right word. Bribe all of them into staying, because right. That's essentially what happened with Carrier. And if you're a halfway competent CEO right now, what you should be doing is threatening to leave, because, you know, even if you don't even plan to, because you can shake down the president for some sweet, sweet tax incentives. Beyond that, it's not clear that even if we did pay off all of these firms and you know, expend lots of money to try to get them to stay, it's not clear that it would actually help that many U.S. workers, given that automation is also taking their jobs. So the firms might stay here, but if the workers are being replaced by robots, that doesn't exactly preserve their jobs.
So, Sudeep, what do we do with this then? I mean, if his stated policy, he literally said yesterday, Donald Trump did, I'm going to call you. You're going to get a phone call and we're going to tax you at the border and there will be consequences and all of this stuff.
What we've heard for a year and a half is that Trump is a fundamentally different politician and Trump will be a fundamentally different policymaker. This is a new game that we're dealing with. It is reality show economics. It is a very different approach to managing the economy. It will be dramatic. It will be unpredictable. Whether it can scale is a big question. Whether it can be done not on a scale of 800 jobs, but 800,000 jobs is the big question here. Mm-hmm. We all know that there's no overarching economic policy framework that was built around this issue other than trying to use some combination of carrots and sticks. But you can't do that in a country of 300 million people, 800 jobs at a time. It doesn't do that. It doesn't work that way. And we all know that if President Barack Obama or a hypothetical President Hillary Clinton tried to do what Donald Trump just did, the wrath of the conservative movement would have come down on them. So this Trump is, we're 3 weeks into this. He's getting a pass on a lot of this stuff. We need to see what he actually does when he takes office.
Come January the 20th, Catherine, and quickly here, does he do those things he said he would do, pulling out of NAFTA and rearranging trade agreements? I mean, it looks like he's serious about what he was saying.
It certainly looks likely that he will pursue a different trade policy. A lot of the other economic policies that he has proposed, I'm somewhat more skeptical about. I think he'll go for a big tax cut, amongst other things. But a lot of the other policies that he's talked about, or at least the outcomes of those policies, including 4% growth, for example,
right,
I think will be very challenging for him to execute.
Which his Treasury Secretary-designate Steve Mnuchin was talking about just the other day. All right, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal. On a Jobs Day Friday. Thanks, you too.
Thanks, guys.
All right, have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, it was mixed-ish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, a bit more now from that unemployment report. First of all, manufacturing jobs. They were down 4,000 from October. That continues a long-term trend, as you know, if you heard any of the carrier coverage the past couple of days. Second of all, though, the labor market has been growing in the service economy. Information technology, for instance, but also lower wage, lower skilled jobs at the bottom end of the income ladder. Leisure and hospitality, healthcare and retail as well. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on the labor market that is creating lots of jobs, but not all jobs that are created equal.
Let's start at the high end. If you've got a BA or better, your unemployment rate is 2.3%, half the national average. In fields like information technology, finance, medicine, even the skilled building trades, says Harry Holzer at Georgetown University.
The workers that have the skills that are in short supply benefit the most because they can command a higher wage or salary when they get hired.
But here's the surprise. At the low end of the skills ladder, things are also going pretty well. There's a lot of job creation and pretty strong wage growth, too, especially in sectors like restaurants, hotels, and healthcare. It's what Holzer calls polarization of the job market, with growth at the top and the bottom and hollowing out in the middle.
The production jobs, the manufacturing jobs, even clerical jobs, good-paying middle-wage jobs for people with no more than a high school education have really been disappearing.
With less demand for those workers comes lower wages. They get hired temporary or part-time. Ultimately, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation, many move into lower-skilled service jobs that pay less.
Jobs in retail stores, about $15 an hour. You know, hotels or restaurants, about $13 an hour. Average manufacturing job pays $20 an hour, and we should be doing more to help people get those skills and to create those opportunities.
Stettner says that'll take worker retraining and industrial policy at the national and local levels to help U.S. producers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If shopping happens to be on your list of things to do this weekend, a couple of things about that. One, just try to ignore all the holiday music playing. All right. Number two, there are going to be some pretty good deals on coats. And number three, in a lot of the parts of this country, it doesn't feel like coat weather, even though it is December. Marketplace's Jed Kim makes all of that make sense.
Remember when you were eight and your parents dragged you to the store to try on coats and it was August? To be fair, that used to make sense. Winter is coming and all that.
Consumer doesn't buy that way anymore. They now buy more on a need-now, use-now basis.
Marshall Cohen is chief retail analyst at the NPD Group. He says that buy-when-you-need-it tendency plays hell when cold weather takes longer to arrive.
Or even not at all. We've seen some winters over the past few years where consumers didn't even buy coats because, frankly, it didn't get cold enough for them to need it, or they could get by with the one that they had from last year.
Retailers have had to mark down their outerwear to clear storerooms. That's cut down on margins. It's a lot of uncertainty that's made fund managers nervous about investing in retail. Lawrence Haverty is a portfolio manager at Gabelli Funds.
The apparel industry is very treacherous for the fundamental reason that there has been climate change and winters have been mild in the last several years.
But after several years of this, Haverty says the time's right to buy back into Macy's and JCPenney.
You can't break your neck pulling out of the basement, and we're kind of in the basement in these stocks.
Guess what else he's thinking of buying?
I actually was trying to figure out how I could get some time to go down to the big coat sale at Lord & Taylor because I need a winter coat, and they certainly are on sale.
He didn't say whether he'd be dragging any kids along with him. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
As we mentioned right at the end of the program yesterday, Howard Schultz is stepping down as the CEO of Starbucks. He's going to concentrate on the rollout of a new premium coffee brand, Starbucks Reserve. more premium than regular Starbucks, that is. It's a move that Schultz compares to Ralph Lauren's launch of his high-end purple label. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports on what lessons Mr. Schultz might learn from Mr. Lauren.
All of Ralph Lauren's clothing is kind of expensive. But the purple label, launched in 1994, screams luxury. Its made-to-measure suits cost thousands of dollars. The clothing maker doesn't break out sales figures, but Renee Richardson-Goslin, who teaches marketing at MIT, says the label has sold well. One reason? The experience of buying a purple label suit is very different from buying a Ralph Lauren polo at, say, a department store.
You're not kind of digging through racks. It feels very posh. It feels very intimate.
Goslin says these stores appeal to a different set of customers, so the purple label doesn't cannibalize the rest of the business, a key lesson for Starbucks. The coffee company is planning to feature the Starbucks Reserve brand at tasting rooms, offering a more artisanal experience. Sardar Dormisholu, marketing professor at the University of Dayton, says, like the purple line, that sends a signal, in this case to coffee drinkers.
That we are the name for good coffee.
Premium brands aren't just about driving new sales. They're also a way to enhance the reputation of a brand overall. Joel Bynes is a retail consultant at Alex Partners.
The vast majority of the revenue and the profits is driven by consumers who will never set foot in one of the premium stores, but will continue to set foot in one of the traditional stores because they still view that brand as aspirational.
It's a strategy other companies have used successfully. Just ask Ralph Lauren. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
...2016 has been an unusual year, shall we say, in the politics of the global economy. Brexit, us, this weekend, perhaps Italy. There's a referendum there on Sunday on constitutional changes that would let the Italian government push through economic reforms more easily. But from Rome, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports the government might be in for a surprise.
In his workshop on the outskirts of Rome, carpenter Pier Luigi Cosati makes furniture and shop fittings. After much careful calibration, he's decided how he's going to vote in the referendum.
I will vote yes. I don't think it's good to stop the reform, yes, because we are molto lenti, molto burocratici.
Things are very slow here and very bureaucratic, he says. We need change. In his offices in the heart of Rome, insurance broker Andrea De Giacomo makes the same complaint. He calls Italy's public sector bloated and indolent.
We run, they walk.
You mean you as business people run?
We as a private business people, at least we try to run, they walk.
He supports the Prime Minister's drive to boost Italy's chronically low growth and reduce its monumental debt. By streamlining the machinery of government, Di Giacomo believes Renzi will be able to cut public spending and further reform the labour market. You will certainly be voting yes.
Yes. Yes.
And yes again.
And yes again.
But many Italians may well vote no by way of protest against the government. Prime Minister Renzi hasn't helped. He said he'll quit if the referendum goes against him. That's been gleefully exploited by opposition leaders like this one. C'è tutti I diritti sull'ambiente, sull'energia. Glad-handing the protesters at a rally last weekend, Beppe Grillo, charismatic leader of the Five Star Movement. His party is anti-corruption, anti-austerity, anti-euro and anti-establishment. He's calling for a no vote. Five-star lawmaker Manlio Di Stefano thinks that after Brexit and Trump's election win, the no voters have a good chance of victory.
If there is some connection between everything that's going on in the world, from Trump to Brexit to the Italian referendum, is that nobody has listened to the people's voice up to now, and we need to listen to people.
And he says if there's a no vote, Renzi resigns, the government falls and Five Star takes power, it will hold another referendum on whether Italy should pull out of the euro.
The big error that we think that was made in the past was to bring Italy into the eurozone without asking to people. We just want to bring back power to the people.
If the euro's third biggest economy did pull out, it could easily crash the single currency. This could be the ultimate consequence of people voting no in this weekend's referendum. Michel Martone, a former deputy Labour minister, says the no voters, ironically, are motivated by fear.
Italy is afraid to change, as well as many Americans were afraid about globalization, voted for Trump. The problem is many people are just only have fear. This is what it scares me.
The bells of St. Peter's Basilica ring out over central Rome. No doubt the theologians scuttling along the Vatican corridors would delight in the labyrinthine complexities of Italy's political system. Among the mind-bending possibilities, Renzi could resign and then be reappointed. There might be an election and another constitutional referendum. The only hope for clarity would be a resounding yes this Sunday. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Love his directness, his bluntness, his profanity at times.
I'd swear here, but that would just get me in trouble. General James Mattis, United States Marine Corps, retired at the Pentagon. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 21 points this Friday, about a 10%, 19,170. The NASDAQ up 4 points, less than a 10%, 5255. The S&P 500 up less than a point, basically unchanged, 2191. For the week, the 5 days that we just lived through, the Dow up a 10%, the NASDAQ lost about 2 2/3%, the S&P 500 off 1%. Starbucks, we told you about, skimmed off 2 2/10% today. That other coffee chain, Dunkin' Brands, yes, some people do want coffee with those donuts, although I personally think their coffee's overrated. It cooled down 2 1/10%. You know where to send your emails, folks. We talked about warmer winters and outerwear sales. Burlington stores and Columbia Sportswear unchanged. Macy's layered up 1/10 of 1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Another key job in the Trump administration has been filled. Retired Marine Corps General James Mattis is the president-elect's pick for Secretary of Defense. The official announcement comes on Monday, or at least that's what the president-elect said last night. It is unconventional, to say the least, to name a retired general officer to run the Pentagon for a whole lot of reasons. Erin Simpson lays out many of them in a new piece at the commentary website War on the Rocks, where she is a senior editor. Erin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
You are, we should say right at the outset, an admirer of General Mattis.
I am. Very much so.
How come?
Partially, I think, because my first job coming out of graduate school was with the Marines. I taught Marine officers down at Quantico, and there's something really special about the Marine Corps ethos. So love it or hate it, it's very identifiable, and I certainly bought into that pretty quickly.
And yet you say he should not be Secretary of Defense. It's not that he's unqualified, right?
Not at all. No, but he... I think should not. And I hope we get a chance to explore some of that at what will be his confirmation hearings.
I'm sure Congress is going to ask him a whole bunch of questions, some of which I'm going to ask you now. First of all, the Department of Defense as a bureaucracy. You say in this piece on War on the Rocks, General Mattis is as much a warrior as you have ever known, and yet the bureaucracy at the Department of Defense is not his thing.
That's right. And I've gotten some pushback on that point. He certainly has had some senior level 4-star commands. But the Pentagon is a special kind of beast. You have to deal with procurement and personnel issues and inter-service rivalries and, of course, the White House. And it's been quite some time since he's worked in the building itself. So I think that that's going to pose some challenges.
You say in this piece, and I'm going to euphemize here, it's not that he's unqualified. It's that he hates this stuff.
Stuff. That's right. Most of us who enjoy General Mattis and appreciate his unique style in many ways love his directness, his bluntness, his profanity at times. I certainly enjoy that. That's going to be a tough road to hoe in this administration where that's well represented already. We really would need him to be to toe the line much more carefully, particularly with management of allies and making sure that our kind of steady commitments to the defense posture that we've maintained continues. That's not what you go to Mattis for.
Talk to me for a second about the thing that everybody has to do, even the Secretary of Defense, and that is managing up and dealing with his boss.
Yeah, the NSC is quite large, and of course,
the National Security Council.
Yeah. That's right, and Lieutenant General Flynn, as the National Security Advisor, kind of oversees that broad apparatus. You know, but as a Secretary of Defense, he has the obligation and the prerogative as the senior civilian defense advisor. Of course, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, also a Marine, General Dunford, will provide that military counsel to the president as well. But the Secretary of Defense has a very unique role as that second person in the chain of command after the commander in chief, after the president, and will need to be, I think, very judicious in how they present, you know, countervening ideas or criticism to the president.
You mentioned General Flynn, who's going to be the National Security Advisor. You mentioned General Dunford, the sitting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There are many other generals in the mix that are being talked about in the Trump administration. Petraeus, General Kelly, Stan McChrystal is being talked about. Let's take a little detour here to civilian control of the military.
Yeah.
General Mattis will need a waiver from Congress because he is a recently retired military officer. But that larger point of the flag officers in that administration.
I think that that's certainly one of the concerns. You know, we're not just talking about General Mattis in isolation. So that really brings a very top-heavy military outlook to the cabinet. There are, senior civilians and seasoned civilians, you know, who can fill some of these roles. And so to turn immediately to the general officers just strikes me as a bit of a caution.
Erin Simpson, her piece at War on the Rocks is called I Love Mattis, But I Don't Love Him as SecDef. Erin, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai. It was a pleasure.
However you define it, we are headed into the holiday season, a time rich in the history of traditions and symbolism. Design historian Sarah Archer explains some of that history in her new book. It's called Mid-Century Christmas. It is today's installment of our series, Holidays, brought to you by...
The American dream had a golden age. 1945 to 1973, to be exact. What began with a burst of unprecedented economic prosperity following the end of World War II ended with the 1973 oil embargo, which unfolded against the backdrop of the Watergate hearings and a dreamy soundtrack of Elton John and the Carpenters classics. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. The post-war boom years totally transformed the way Americans thought about house and home. In 1940, 43.6% of Americans owned their home. By 1960, 61.9% did. This was due in large measure to the benefits of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill, which gave returning soldiers funding to start new businesses, attend college or graduate school, and obtain home mortgages. The focus on home and hearth was not new during the post-war era. The 19th century gave rise to what historians call the cult of domesticity, as industrialization increasingly split men's and women's roles between the outside world of business and commerce and the interior world of family, housework, and nurturance. But Americans did have a good new reason to fixate on the domestic front. With Great Britain ravaged by the war, even in victory, the two new superpowers that emerged in 1945, the United States and the Soviet Union, were both large, formidable, and ideologically opposed to one another on the basis of their respective economic systems. Newfound prosperity coupled with worry about possible conflict with the Soviets meant that middle-class homeowners doubled down on domesticity. Their increased buying power drove sales of home appliances and improvements to rates far higher than the consumptions of other goods like clothing, travel, or entertainment. In 1958, Bank of America unveiled the first consumer credit card. And by 1960, there were more than 100 million of them in use in the United States. So for Americans who had put their spending habits on hold since the stock market crash of 1929, the end of World War II meant happy days were here again at long last.
Sarah Archer there. She's the author of the book Mid-Century Christmas. You can check out some of the pictures that she dug up for her book. We've got them on our Instagram. It's @MarketplaceAPM. Final note on the way out today, two quickies, actually, both about Snapchat, or Snap Inc., I guess it's now called. First of all, those new Snapchat spectacles, the ones that let you take snaps right from your face. You can now get prescription lenses for those glasses if you want to wear them all the time, I suppose. Also, and this one is definitely today's entrant in the what could possibly go wrong sweepstakes. The University of Wisconsin-Green Bay is going to let admitted students know whether they got in or not via Snapchat, which, if you think about it, does make some sense. You go where your audience is, right? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 21 points this Friday, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 4 points. That's about a 10%, maybe a little less. The S&P 500 edged up less than a point. We'll call that one unchanged. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Satara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.